From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, will standardized testing make the grade in the Texas legislature? Many students, parents, and teachers are saying it's a failure.
It is a big issue for parents. And, you know, the benchmarks in those grades, if they don't pass them, they don't promote, or they have to take them in summer school until they do pass them. It is very stressful.
Who grades the graders? We hear what it's like behind the scenes where the tests end up.
The score the student is given results on a lot of things that aren't necessarily the quality of their work.
And with $1 million war chest at the ready, is the Texas Republican Party headed for a civil war this next primary? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. State lawmakers are preparing to file a slew of bills that could change the way students are tested and the way school districts are graded. The lightning rod is the new star into the course exams. KERA's Shelley Koffler visited the Arlington School District, where there's a loud cry for reform.
Taylor Griffin feels like she's always preparing for a test or taking one. We caught up with the Arlington High School sophomore at lunchtime after she'd spent the morning in final exams.
Yeah, it's really stressful. Like, you just have to study a lot, and it's not fun.
And these routine tests given by her teachers are only the beginning. Taylor and every other Texas high school student will take 15 STAR exams over 3 years. STAR is the new statewide testing program replacing TACS. STAR tests are given at the end of major high school courses in math, English, science, and social studies. They're tougher than TACS. There are more of them. And Taylor has to make a minimum score on each to graduate. Taylor used to ace the TACS, but says she's not doing as well on STAR.
It kind of, like, upsets me. I thought that, like, it made me feel good when I got really good grades on the TACS test. And now at the STAR, I don't even get, like, commended anymore, and it's just weird.
Does it discourage you a little bit?
Yeah, I feel like I'm still trying really hard, but it's just not going how it used to.
The concern that even good students like Taylor will lose interest in school is part of the reason Arlington Superintendent Marcelo Cavazos hopes the legislature and the Texas Education Agency overhaul STAR.
The students can become demoralized when you're navigating through 15 different assessments to obtain a high school diploma, and you're navigating through your coursework, the courses, the credits that are required for graduation, and then 15 end-of-course assessments. Can be very difficult.
Last year, when STAR exams were given for the first time, the standards for passing were lower than they will be when the tests are completely phased in. Even so, more than 1,800 Arlington freshmen failed the English part of the exam. That's almost half the freshman class. Hundreds more failed other parts of the test. Now they have to retake those tests until they pass, or they won't graduate.
What is the point of the exam? That's the question. Students experience school in a variety of ways, through career programs, through fine arts, through athletics, through extracurricular activities. And so where does the other part of the school experience that we know is very significant for students and their success, where is that in the mix?
State Representative Diane Patrick, a former Arlington School Board member and educator, agrees the system needs a fix.
I have heard from parents, and I've heard from teachers and principals and superintendents and school board members from all over the state that we need to tap the brakes and work this out a little better so that, again, we can be sure that it has a fair implementation.
Patrick isn't divulging many details, but says she plans to introduce legislation that could reduce the number of STAR tests and the requirement that students pass all of them. Revamping the program can't come soon enough for Nikki Griffin, Taylor's mom.
It is a big issue for parents, especially I have a third grader as well, or fourth grader as well. And, you know, the benchmarks, you know, in those grades, if they don't pass them, they don't promote, or they have to take them in summer school until they do pass them. It is very stressful.
Taylor's mother says she wishes Texas could return to the good old days when the goal of tests was to find out what students had learned. She feels the new testing program sometimes punishes students instead.
My conversations sort of go like this in 4 months: accountability. Accountability, accountability.
So what is this school accountability system Education Commissioner Michael Williams is hearing about and plans to fix? In its simplest form, though it's not simple, it's two things. The new STAR test students must pass to advance or graduate, and the way those tests are used to grade schools and districts. Bad grades can eventually lead to the commissioner reorganizing or shutting down a school. The commissioner also ties something else to accountability. The core courses high school students are required to take to graduate. Williams wants to add options to the list.
We ought to be looking at how we can identify math and science courses that have rigor, but that fit the fields that kids might want to go into, so that everybody still has 4 years of rigor in math and 4 years of rigor in science, but maybe the kid that wants to be in the construction business takes construction geometry, or a kid that is excited about the possibility of flying people around takes aviation or something like that.
When I hear the complaints about accountability, what I usually hear complaints about is the testing.
I would say that the legislature is going to make a determination whether they have too many, but let's go back to something. There are two different aspects to testing. One is the number of end-of-course exams, and whether it's 15 or whatever. The other one is all of the tests that you take in preparation. State law says that you cannot have tests more than 10% of the school year. That's 18 days. If school districts are testing 40 and 45 days, that's because they're doing something, quite frankly, that is outside of state law.
But make no mistake, Williams thinks testing is crucial.
We do measure what we treasure. And so it seems to me if we want to make sure that youngsters are getting it, then we're going to have to test them.
Maybe his biggest accountability change will be the way the state grades schools. Superintendents have complained that if just one demographic group of students fails their tests, a specific ethnic group, for example, then the entire school or district could be labeled unsatisfactory.
I've heard that, and we're moving towards an index. And the index will have at least four features to it. One would be student achievement. That's the way we do it today. One would be how are you closing the racial achievement gap.
His other two measures for rating schools, improvement of test scores from year to year, and whether the scores show students are prepared for college or a job.
That will sort of balance out the pressures, if you will.
The commissioner also plans to replace the school rating system of exemplary or unsatisfactory with familiar letter grades of A through F.
Folks understand what that is.
It's one simplification of a very complex accountability system. Shelley Koffler, KERA News.
What happens after the standardized test? The students leave, the test papers are gathered, sealed in a special package, and sent off. But to where? Who grades them? For years, Todd S. Farley worked in the standardized testing industry as a grader, and he wrote a book about his experiences called Making the Grade, My Misadventures in the Standardized Testing Industry.
The gist of my observation is, and one of the first things I wrote, is that every score given to a student is based on a number of variables, only one of which is the quality of their answers. I'm talking mostly about open-ended and essay questions, which is why I spend a lot of time scoring and training and supervising other people at scoring. And the gist of it is, again, if a student answers one question or 20 questions, the score they'll ultimately get depends on how well they answer the question, but also which, you know, temporary score reads their answers, what time of day it is, what point in the project it is, what scoring center around the country it's sent to, whether or not scoring rules have changed from the beginning of a project to an end. And so my point was, it's sort of like the score the student is given results on a lot of things that aren't necessarily the quality of their work.
Normally when people hear about standardized testing, they're thinking about filling the dot bubbles with the number two pencil. But actually there's a lot, and particularly nowadays, a lot of essay writing that's involved.
Right, exactly. One of the criticisms of standardized testing is that multiple choice tests are very sort of limiting. You know, all you have to do is fill in the bubbles, as it were. So one way people say they can be more robust is to ask open-ended questions. You know, a student will read a science passage or a reading passage, and then they'll be asked specific questions about them, and the students write their own answers.
But the grading of all these hundreds of thousands of tests, very, very difficult, I imagine.
In your state in Texas, for one question, if there's 100,000 students answer a question, then all 100,000 of those need to be scored. And they supposedly need to be scored in a standardized way. And the only way you can do that is establish these sort of rigid rules that become absurdist in the end. And in my book, there are numerous instances of me standing in front of a group of 100 scorers trying to get them to score in a standardized way when you're dealing with fourth graders. But for instance, I remember standing in front of 100 scorers, and we were debating about what would be acceptable when students were asked, what is your favorite food, in response to a reading passage about the taste buds. And we were trying to decide what was an acceptable favorite food. And so, of course, you know, if someone said, my favorite food is green beans, we'd say, yeah, that's great. But if they said it was soda, should we accept that? And then, well, what if they said it was rock candy? And then what if they said they like to eat mud? Was that an acceptable answer? And there's all this back and forth about what's an acceptable answer. And we scorers debated it, but also when we were writing the rules, the teachers who were giving us advice would debate it. So there's never sort of a straight answer, and it becomes just sort of madness.
So the point we're trying to get here is that, you know, these kids are being assigned a grade, you know, how well they did on these tests. Their future
right.
is largely dependent upon this, whether they pass or fail and what they're able to accomplish. And you're saying that there's really a lot of arbitrary and sometimes some breakdowns in the grading of these tests.
Oh, absolutely. And it's not just me who said that. I always make the point. In 2001, the New York Times did an expose in test scoring in which people working at the company said, you know, look, this isn't going very well. They said there's too many tests to score. There's too little time. We don't have enough employees to do it. And that was 11 years ago, 12 years ago. And now the testing industry is 100 times bigger than that. But the problems that have been brought up for the last 10 or 12 years have never been addressed. There have been other scorers other than me who have been whistleblowers about this who have said, look, this is a bunch of silliness. You know, you can't get tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of answers scored in a two-week period with any sort of logic. So there's lots of people are saying, lots of whistleblowers from inside the industry have said, this is foolish. And I think everyone agrees that it's sort of foolish and inconsistent and unstandardized, but it's never addressed. And I don't know if that's due to ignorance or just, you know, greed on the part of testing companies.
Todd S. Farley is a former grader of standardized tests, like the STAR test in Texas. He wrote a book about his experiences called Making the Grade: My Misadventures in the Standardized Testing Industry. They say as long as we have tests in schools, we'll have student prayer in schools. But what happens when the test is about the Bible? It's been 5 years since the legislature passed a law that allows the holy book to be studied in Texas classrooms. The reasoning is the Bible is a significant work of literature and history, and it's dominant in our culture. But a new study finds that some of these Bible classes are being taught with blatant religious bias in violation of that 2007 law. The report is from the Texas Freedom Network and was written by Southern Methodist University professor Mark Chancey.
Well, it's definitely the case that the Bible is a culturally important book and that an educated person knows something about the Bible. So I think most people can agree on that. And the Supreme Court was very clear that it is okay to study the Bible and other religious texts in public schools as long as the study is done in a way that's academically and constitutionally appropriate. The question is, how do you teach the Bible in that way to meet those benchmarks? And that's where our study found some very mixed results. We found some school districts, 11 in particular, that were very rigorous academically and were very careful in not promoting any particular religious viewpoints over others. Most other courses had problems of different degrees, and 21 courses were especially problematic. They were typically taught from a Sunday school perspective more than a public school perspective.
Now, these are in public schools, ISD-type places. These are not charter schools or homeschool-type things.
The courses we looked at were in 57 public school districts and 3 charter school districts. And charter schools are bound by the same laws on this as our public schools, regular public schools.
So charter schools don't get a pass?
Charter schools do not get a pass. That's correct.
So they're teaching the Bible and they're saying that this is a, you need to look at this as a literal description of the way that the universe operates.
That's right. Some courses do this, a fair number. You know, all of these courses would say, all of the people teaching these courses would say that they are teaching them in an academically sound, neutral manner. But many courses present the biblical material as if it is a history textbook and that everything happened in it exactly as reported, including even the miracle stories. And so students are being taught that theological faith claims are historically accurate, theologically accurate, scientifically accurate, and that is directly against what the Texas Bible law specifies and against what the Supreme Court has stated.
Science and religion, you know, they've since Galileo haven't gotten along too well. So I guess the main things that people are thinking about is about what about creationism or intelligent design versus evolution or even how old the world is.
Sure, and those are some of the things that come up. So, for example, there are several districts that try to reconcile the Genesis creation story with modern science by proposing different ways that the Genesis six-day creation could be accurate. Maybe each day represented a really long time, and so you can reconcile Genesis with the very old universe. Or maybe there was a very long gap between each of those 6 days in Genesis, that sort of thing, where students are being taught that these are credible scientific theories that a lot of people hold. Well, those are religious views that some people hold. One school district included in its materials a religious tract claiming that NASA had found a missing day in time that shows that the sun stood still, just as reported in the biblical book of Joshua. That is that's an urban legend.
Because I didn't know that.
Well, neither did NASA. I called them and asked them about that to see if they had ever issued a statement. And, in fact, there's a NASA webpage that says, no, this is an urban legend. Why is that showing up in instructional materials for a public school Bible course? These are the sorts of real issues that I think we should be concerned about. You know, I'm an educator, and I just think Bible courses need to be held to the same rigorous academic standards as a course on science, a course on history, a course in English. And I'm especially passionate about the importance of safeguarding religious liberty here. In a public school setting, a Bible course does not need to promote one person's religious viewpoint over all other viewpoints.
Mark Chauncey is a professor of religious studies at Southern Methodist University. He authored a report about problems with Bible classes in Texas public and charter schools. The Texas legislature got its first look at the new budget this week. The draft budget looks grim, despite the projected revenue surplus. Thus far, the education funding cuts from 2 years ago are not restored, and there are big fat zeros where the funding should be for standardized testing. That could effectively kill the STAR test, but as Harvey Kronberg of the Quorum Report explains, that's not expected to be the case.
The opinion in most of the legislature is that we're spending way too much money on testing. And normally when they put a zero line item in, it really means that there's no negotiating position. But I think in this case, what they want the testing vendors to do is to make their case from zero and start from zero and add from there. I don't think that this means that we're going to eliminate standardized testing.
But it certainly indicates the mood of the House, I imagine, that if they put these goose eggs there, it shows that they're serious about challenging this.
I think that's exactly correct, and it's not just the House. This is a common sentiment on both sides of the chamber of the legislature, and it's interesting. One of the other great zero goose eggs is the Texas Enterprise Fund, the Emerging Technology Fund, the Film Commission, a lot of the funds that are available for the governor to make and close deals to lure business to Texas. Those were zeroed, and it's the same message. Justify why we should do this, and we need to have stronger oversight.
But certainly what we've seen of budget proposals so far is that the lawmakers are in they're not in a spending mood. It seems to meet the new budget, same as the old budget.
Yes. I don't think that there's any desire here to restore anything necessarily. The strength of the Tea Party in the last Republican primary, I think, was seen as a warning shot. Political pundits like myself can argue whether the Tea Party is going to be durable over time, but the sentiment is still for austerity as opposed to restoring funding.
Well, some people who are not short on cash are many of our big-name political office holders in Texas. Greg Abbott, good gracious, how much has he raised?
In this last reporting period, he raised a little under $4 million, as I recall. But he's got $18 million in the bank. That means all that means is that he's had 8 years of office where he's been raising money, and he's had no challengers, so he's had no reason to spend any money. It's banked money. An apples-to-apples comparison would be that he raised roughly the same amount of money as Governor Perry during that period and Governor Dewhurst. While he looks formidable because of all the money he's got in the bank, we shouldn't read too much into that if in fact, Governor Perry did decide to run for re-election. I would presume that his fundraising capacity would be substantial.
But Attorney General Greg Abbott is certainly being more forthcoming, although he hasn't actually announced, but he's talking like he is going to run for governor, whether or not Rick Perry's there.
And most of us in the press corps and around the Capitol do believe that whether or whatever decision Rick Perry makes, Greg Abbott is going to run. This is his time in 2014. He's already got enough money on hand. His approval rating is higher than the governor's and has been for a long time, particularly among Republican primary voters. A lot of Governor Perry's former campaign staff is now working in and around Attorney General Abbott's campaign. So we've got a circumstance where it does not look like he's going to be stampeded out of the race.
Now, this is not the only primary infighting of big-name Texas politicians that's going to happen. We're seeing Comptroller Susan Combs. She's contemplating a run for lieutenant governor. Also, Agricultural Commissioner Todd Staples and Land Commissioner Jerry Patterson. And Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst says he's not going anywhere.
That's correct. Dewhurst, though, is perceived as having been wounded deeply by the last election. He only has 2 years to rehabilitate himself among Republican primary voters. But the circumstances will be dramatically different at that point. It'll be the filing deadline will be in late December. And the election will be in March, early March. That's only about 60 days of real campaign, as opposed to the last election where it was almost a six-month-long campaign and there was a lot of outside money to help Ted Cruz. It is, for me, very unclear whether Todd Staples will actually make the run. Susan Combs has obviously got some political baggage. Jerry Patterson is the only one who is unwavering in his stated commitment to make the run.
And then we have nephew of George W. Bush and the grandson of George Herbert Walker Bush. We have George P. Bush, who is going to run for something we don't know yet, and he managed still to raise $1.3 million.
65% of that money came from 30 donors, most of whom were part of former President George W. Bush's Pioneers Group, the mega donors. This is mostly just funding the family business at this stage. I don't mean to put down George P. Bush. He may prove to be a powerful political figure and a compelling personality. But at this stage, shopping for an office, splashing money, makes you take serious notice of him. He has yet to demonstrate any political skills.
Harvey Kronberg is the editor of the Quorum Report, an online newsletter that covers Texas politics. The Texas legislature is taking some extra time off this week because of the presidential inauguration. Many of the state's Democrat lawmakers have jetted off to Washington, D.C. to join the massive celebration. Also celebrating will be many of the Latino celebrities, public officials, and community leaders who worked on the Obama campaign and who now hope to be rewarded with comprehensive immigration reform.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear.
I, Barack Hussein
Obama, he won the election. Now Barack Obama is preparing to once again take the presidential oath of office.
President to the United States faithfully.
That I will execute.
Faithfully, the office of President of the United States.
Okay, so last time there was a little flub, but now he's getting another crack at it. And at inaugurations, there are also parties, lots of parties. They call them balls. There's a ball for pretty much every state in the union. There's a green inaugural ball, an American Indian inaugural, one for African American churches. You get the idea. And there's going to be a Latino inaugural ball. It's more like a star-studded extravaganza concert at the Kennedy Center and hosted by star Eva Longoria. Mark Anthony is performing. Jose Feliciano will jam.
Life can be bright in America
if you can fight in America.
And Rita Moreno will entertain.
There aren't words exciting enough or good enough to describe how I feel about this. I'm jumping up and down like a child.
Folks going to the Latino inaugural ball are in for a historic spectacle. Rita Moreno, for the first time, will share the stage with another Latina star of Broadway, Chita Rivera. Both won accolades for their portrayal of Anita in West Side Story. And the audience will be a who's who of Latinos in politics. Moreno said they're going to get a night to remember.
And the people who are going to be in that show are so extraordinary.
Too bad Chris Garcia won't be there. He couldn't get a ticket. Still, he's excited.
It's history.
Garcia traveled from San Antonio to Washington, D.C. to witness the swearing-in.
There's only going to be one first black president, and there's only going to be one first black president to get reelected.
Garcia was an Obama campaign volunteer in South Texas, and his wife surprised him with D.C. plane tickets as a Christmas present. He quickly started asking around for tickets to the inauguration. He did get those tickets, and he'll be watching closely both swearing-ins.
Sonia Sotomayor will be giving Vice President Biden. She'll be performing the oath with him, and that's the first time a Latina judge does that.
Garcia said he will be listening very carefully to President Obama's second inaugural address, keeping an ear cocked for the words immigration reform.
With the Latino turnout and how important it was that they have to address immigration.
I'm going to take the president at his word that in 2013, his priority is to pass immigration reform.
That's Henry Munoz. Yeah, he's got a ticket to the Kennedy Center Latino Ball. He's got a front row seat. He's the event organizer, and he worked raising money for the Obama campaign.
It was one of the most incredible experiences of my life.
Munoz says there are multiple reasons for the celebration, not just Barack Obama's reelection, but also the critical role that Latinos had in that election victory.
Well, it certainly was a historic election. For the first time in the history of presidential politics, Latinos contributed more than 10% of the vote. I think it's an important moment to reflect on that moment, but also to think about what comes next.
And Munoz is certain that means immigration reform. And he said all that Latino political muscle gathered in D.C. will do more than party. They're going to hold a symposium to look at how to continue to build Latino participation in elections and turn that participation into power. And to borrow a quote from Anita from West Side Story, life can be bright in America if you can fight in America. Fight in the political arena. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with your questions and comments about the program to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also post your comments directly on our website at tpr.org. That's also where you can find many of our past Texas Matters programs. And you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.